From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Rachel Dickinson had been married to her husband a few years before she learned about a deep obsession he had for falconry. She says he had given up the sport for a time, but then he showed up at home with a small falcon in a paper bag. It took a while for Dickinson to understand the depth of the connection between her husband and his birds. In her book, Falconer on the Edge, she explores the sport and that connection. These aren't pets. This is a working relationship that calls on all the senses when they're out hunting together in the field. It's primal, she says, and it's exclusive. Today in the program, Rachel Dickinson will join us to talk about her book, A Profile of a Falconer, though not her husband. It's about the fascinating history and culture of falconry. It also happens to be a very Western story about the relationship of people to creatures and to land. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Rachel Dickinson set out to profile the sport of falconry, she didn't have to look very far to find a practitioner. Her husband was a falconer, though she didn't know it when she met him. Her idea was to write a portrait of a falconer, but she didn't want to learn about the sport from her husband, and she confesses in the book that she has written, she's not exactly sure why. She did find a falconer to profile, though, a man by the name of Steve Schindgren, whose passion for the sport and the birds was ignited in the canyons of Utah where he grew up. Her book is called Falconer on the Edge, and it explores the culture and the history of the sport, but also the connection to the birds and the people who take them hunting. This is also a very Western story. It's about land and development also. Today in the program, Rachel Dickinson is joining us to talk about her book, Falconer on the Edge, A Man, His Birds, and the Vanishing Landscape of the American West. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. That sound you're hearing, by the way, is another one of our guests, Jomo, who will introduce to you in a moment here. First, Rachel Dickinson is a science and nature writer whose work has appeared in the Christian Science Monitor, National Geographic, Travel, and Audubon. She's the author of several books. Falconer on the Edge is her first nonfiction work for adults. And thank you very much for joining us, Rachel Dickinson.
Thank you very much for having me.
We should mention that she's going to be speaking at the King's English Bookshop tomorrow. We'll tell you the details about that as we go along. And we're going to talk to him in a moment, but let me introduce the falconer, Steve Schindgren, who is profiled in the book. He's the owner of Sky King Falcons in Centerville, Utah. He and his staff give daily bird shows at Utah's Hogle Zoo. And Steve Schindgren, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And Jomo, welcome to you. Well, let's begin, Rachel, if we could, the way the book does, with this discovery you make. You had met Tim Gallagher, dated, gotten married, been married a couple of years, when you had no idea he had this deep obsession.
No idea. One day, as you said, we'd been married a couple of years. One day he came home from work with a paper bag. I opened up the bag, and inside was a kestrel, which is America's smallest falcon. Mm-hmm. And I just looked at this bird, and Tim got all excited, and he said, oh, I have to build a muse. I have to get my paperwork in order. I have to get some food. And I just looked at him like he'd grown an extra head. And he said, what? I'm a falconer. And I said, what? You're a falconer? Why didn't I know this? He said, I don't know. I just haven't flown a bird in about 10 years. And his falconry was so deeply in remission, it just literally never came up.
Remission is a good word, especially as we explore how much of a passion this becomes for people.
Mm-hmm. Yes. When he started out with his little kestrel, Strawberry, we called her, he would fly her at grasshoppers in the field. And I found it very charming. And our children were small at the time, and they loved it. And they would go romp around in the field like puppies. But then as he got some other birds, particularly McDuff, his peregrine, what I found charming grew a little alarming in a way because he would spend so much time away from home during the hunting season. Every morning he'd get up very early, throw his peregrine in the back and his waders and go out and searching for ducks and duck ponds. And then he would spend part of the morning hunting and then go to work. So it was a full-blown obsession. He would dream about it at night. He would dream that his bird would get lost. So
terrible and wonderful intensity is how you describe it.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. Solitary pursuit also. Mm-hmm. Which and that must be a little alarming too. And this is something you take on in the book when you talk about Steve and his relationship with his wife. That on one hand, these guys, I don't know, are they loners? It's a solitary pursuit, but you say they're never lonely.
No, I don't think Falconers are lonely, but I would call almost all of them that I've met loners. They're extremely comfortable with other Falconers. They love what they do.
Yeah.
They love showing other Falconers their falcons, their hunting fields, and they're amazing when they're with groups of other Falconers. But this really does consume a part of their life that is very hard for a non-Falconer to reach.
I wonder, when did the interest peak? At what point did you figure, I want to write a story about this, or I want to write a book about this?
I think it was about 5 or 6 years into his resurgence into falconry when when it seemed to be getting a little more intense. And there were other intense things he was doing. He works for the Lab of Ornithology at Cornell, and things were going on there. And so I just thought, boy, how can you just keep up this intense schedule all the time? Because no matter what was going on in his life, he made sure he had time to go hunting, because I saw this human-animal bond that formed between Tim and McDuff, and I see Steve and his birds, this incredible bond. And that's what made me really want to look into it. I wanted to kind of explore that bond a little bit, and I thought, oh, well, I can't learn from Tim. I'm just way too close.
Yeah.
He's way too close.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did you find Steve Chingren?
Well, I started really reading everything I could about falconry, and particularly about long-wing falconry, which means flying falcons rather than hawks. And one name kept creeping up and kind of coming into the conversation over and over again. Whenever I would talk to falconers, they would say, well, if you really want to see how it's done, you have to talk to Steve Chingren. He's the guy.
Yeah.
And one day I just picked up the phone and called him and said, I'd love to come to Wyoming and see what you do. And he was so generous and said, sure, come on out.
Did you intend for it to be a biography? Because in a lot of ways it is. And we'll talk about this as we go, but it's about his early life, his early connection to animals, his relationships now, how he works within the community, those kinds of things.
Well, Steve, as I got to know him better, you know, he's such a fascinating person and character. And intense, such intensity. And as I started working on the book, I thought, well, there are three threads that kind of run through here. One is kind of my relationship to my husband and falconry.
Yeah.
The other one is Steve and his relationship to falconry. And the third one would be kind of the relationship that Steve has and Western falconers have to the land and what's going on to the land. So I just tried to blend those three themes.
Rachel, you say in the book that for falconers like Steve and like Tim, falconry defines who they are. What do you mean?
Mm-hmm. I think that even though Tim may not obviously, it's not the first thing he would say to someone.
Sure.
Since he didn't say it to his wife,
right.
You'd think, when you really dig down to who a person is and who they think they are, the more I got to know Steve and the more I got to know Tim, the more I realized this really was at the center. When they are practicing this sport, they are probably the freest that they will ever be. Mm. They're the most intense that they'll ever be, and they're the freest, and they have the closest connection to nature and to these animals.
It seems like that experience, the hunt in particular, which we'll get to in a bit, pretty intense.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah, yeah. At one point, I talk about the fact that I felt like I was at a spectator. I was a spectator at a sport that was not a spectator sport as a non-falconer, you can't participate in the hunt, but you can watch the hunt. And when you're dealing with falcons in particular, they fly so high and they move so fast. Everything happens so fast to a non-falconer. I think a falconer sees time slow down.
Like a good athlete.
Yeah, when they're in the middle of the hunt, time slows down for them. But for the rest of us, it's just over in the blink of an eye. Suddenly, this bird is plummeting to earth, and something is happening on the ground, and feathers kind of fly up in the air, and you think, whoa, what's going on? You know, so it's very intense, but it's quick.
Steve Chingren, how do you describe your relationship with these birds? Do you have a – is there a way you can describe it? How do you describe it?
Well, I've just always had an admiration for nature growing up in the Wasatch Mountains, and I was fortunate to be in that environment as a child, and I always I happened to see a hawk make a kill, and it was at a time in my life when we were studying dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And to me, it was the same type of a predator. And a lot of young boys at that age are drawn by predatory dinosaurs, the yeah. history of them, and they collect, you know, rubber replicas. And I was the same. But when I saw that hawk, I realized, you know, I took my dinosaur picture that I'd had, and I erased the teeth and drew a beak on it and looked it up in the encyclopedia, which is where we went in those days for information. And it said, see, falconry. And when I saw a man training, when I read that you could train them to hunt, and I lived in an environment in the mountains where I thought I could get me a hawk and go off into the hills hunting, which really wasn't realistic, I fell in love with the idea and began to pursue it. And all my thoughts were filled with birds of prey and studying them and knowing all I could about them. And I hiked and photographed and looked at them and got my hands on every book that I could find. Back in those days, there weren't many.
Right. It's funny, you know. It's not. It wouldn't be right to say that they're pets, really. But are
no.
they? But are they wild?
Well, they definitely are wild. They're, yeah. They represent all that is wild. Even though I haven't taken a bird from the wild in 30 years, I've all been captive bred.
Huh.
But they still do allow the taking of birds from the wild, and that is a big part of falconry, because of the wildness of that relationship of a wild bird working with a man. And is an incredible feat to have a bird that was, you know, that would be totally fearful of people, you know, and then to have it actually come to a point where it totally trusts you and becomes your partner and works with you
yeah.
is very rewarding.
Tell us about Jomo. It may not make a lot of sense for some people to have you brought this beautiful bird, but I think it makes sense. We'll take a picture of it, by the way, and put it on our website. I actually love hearing the sound, so why not? But introduce us to
Jomo is a hybrid falcon cross between a gyr falcon and a peregrine, and the reason we do that is because the males are a third smaller than a female, and the males in the wild do the majority of the hunting and provide the female with the food when she's raising her young, so they tend to be a little more of a hunter. And the problem with the male peregrine is they're quite small, not large enough to hunt a larger quarry that I like to hunt, like grouse and ducks. And so when you hybridize the gyr falcon with the peregrine, you get a larger male. Mm-hmm. And it brings in both the qualities of the peregrine and the gyr, which is the same reason we've, you know, through the years hybridized dogs for hunting and things to bring out certain qualities that we use for the hunt. And it's a very popular breed of falcon. We're falconers today.
Yeah. Jomo is 22 years old.
He will be.
He will be.
This will be his 22nd hunting season this year.
Unbelievable.
Which is unbelievable. Rachel, you say this. You say when you watch Steve work with Jomo, which is his oldest bird, he's reminded of himself and his mortality, his aching back and all of the life that he's lived so far.
That's me projecting perhaps on Steve. But yeah, I think that that is what's going on. Jomo is a bird that has taken Steve from his youth into middle age. And, you know, along with everything that's happened to Jomo, all these things have happened to Steve. And I think when he watches him fly and he sees Jomo's a little bit arthritic and is not able to go after the big birds anymore, I think, yeah, it does remind Steve that, oh, I shouldn't be lifting that huge box just using my back because it'll seize up on me. And it is reminding him of getting older.
There's this thread of trust that you talk about, Rachel Dickinson, in the book, the slender thread of trust, you say, between a bird and a falconer. How do you describe it? I wanted to get Steve's perspective on this too, because there has to be a trust. Mm-hmm. You're letting them fly.
This is what is so fascinating to a non-falconer, is to stand there and watch a falconer stand with a bird on his fist, and he just holds his arm up and he just waits. He takes the hood off the bird. The bird is there. He kind of rouses and his wings go out a little bit, and then he takes off. And that's it. You know, to us mere mortals, us non-falconers, we just think, well, why would that bird ever come back, you know? Just go up and over that mountain. But instead, these falcons see, they recognize their falconers. They recognize them as the kind of the giver of all things. They recognize them as their food source.
Yeah.
And that's what brings them back, basically. It's about they trust that the falconer is going to find food for them. And if they don't kick it up out in the field themselves, then they will still provide them with food. And that is what brings them back.
How does Jomo see you, Steve?
Well, Jomo's lived this life for so long. And when a falcon, he recognized my voice. That's why he's more vocal
sure,
when
sure.
I talk. when a falcon really develops a bond with his trainer, because we spend so much time with them, we fly them, you know, regularly in order for them to become successful. They have to have a lot of time out in the field. Mm. And they've become so accustomed to this lifestyle that it becomes a lifestyle that the falcon enjoys and wants to live. And they will, as Rachel says, it initially begins, they come to you for food. But I've had times when Jomo's flown off and made a kill, and I could never find him before dark. And after dark, I've been driving in my car out in the desert, and he's flown in and lit on the car with a full crop of food. He couldn't eat another bite if he had to, and he's come back just to find me to go home.
Wow.
And so that doesn't happen with a falcon that's early on in his training,
right.
But a falcon that becomes, you know, very well associated with the lifestyle, and they learn to like the lifestyle. And falconers today not only provide opportunities for their birds to fly in the field, they put them in situations where they can breed in captivity and raise young, so they get to fulfill all the things that they would fulfill as a wild bird, and so they actually have a pretty good life, and that we make sure that they always get a meal.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take a call from Laura, who's in Nashville, Indiana. Laura, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure.
I am also a master falconer, but I was a raptor rehabber first, and I'm sure that they would recognize the pull to become a falconer after getting birds back in the air from being injured. The main thing for me is that you have to have such a complete understanding of the natural history of these animals for it to work, and it completely changed the way I rehab, because most people get out there and they make sure that the bird can fly, but if the bird can't stop over its prey, there's no point. There's no point in it flying. And falconers have never been given the credit that they deserve for rehabilitation today, as it stands, or for repopulating the peregrines and having forged the breeding methods that they have today. But it's an unbelievable experience to be out there one-on-one with a bird, and you can't think of anything else except for what's happening at the time that your bird's out trying to make a kill.
Hmm. Laura, really glad you called. Rachel, you talk about this, that you have to have you have to have a deep knowledge about the natural world to do this.
You really do, and I see that with every falconer I've been out with, and Laura makes a really good point, because if you don't understand the terrain, if you don't understand the natural history of the prey and the natural history of the predator, if you don't understand the weather conditions, why are you there? You know, the whole point of flying a bird for hunting, which is really truly the essence of falconry, is for you want your bird to be successful. In order for them to be successful, you have to really be able to read the landscape. And so much is going on all at the same time, as I said before, that if you aren't able to do that quickly and become really adept at doing that, you will not be successful.
Rachel Dickinson is with us. She's the author of the book Falconer on the Edge, A Man, His Birds, and the Vanishing Landscape of the American West. Tomorrow at 7 o'clock, she's going to be, along with Steve Chindgren, at the King's English Bookshop talking about the book. For details, you can call the store, 801-484-9100, or just go to our website at kuer.org/Radio West. Laura, glad you called. Thanks very much. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling the intriguing sport, or maybe art, of falconry. It's the subject of Rachel Dickinson's latest book, which is a biography of sorts of one of the country's greatest falconers, Steve Chindgren. He's a Utah native and resident who practices this ancient sport on the sage prairies of Wyoming. The story is also about the threats to the Western environment Chindgren and others are having to contend with, the effects of mining and energy development. The book is called Falconer on the Edge, and Rachel Dickinson is in Utah here to read from her book at the King's English Bookshop. We'll tell you more about that as we go along. In the meantime, we invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Rachel Dickinson, I wanted to ask you, have you read a section, if you wouldn't mind, about the hunt, which you described earlier as a pretty intense kind of experience. Say something about that, if you would, and then read the section.
Sure. In the beginning of the book, I actually have something, a chapter called Hunting in Wyoming, where I try to give people paint a picture for them of what it's like to be out in the field with Steve and with his birds and with Jomo and everything that's going on at the same time. And I'm just going to read you two paragraphs that talk about what happens when Jomo actually finds his prey. Mm. Jomo plummets earthward like a stone falling from a great height, head down, wings folded to his sides. If you could slow that action and take a good look at what's going on during the power dive, you'd see his body elongating and becoming the perfect aerodynamic shape. Somehow he manages to choose one of the five grouse to aim at, and he flies toward the bird indirectly to better use his acute side vision. In the last moments before impact, Jomo shifts the angle and flies directly at the grouse, then hits it, wham, like a pile driver. The soft explosion of feathers falls like a dusting of early winter snow on the predator and his prey. Disney might portray this whole scene as the circle of life, but this isn't a cartoon. And when we witness it, it pulls on some coded prehistoric gene that still remains from the time when we were hunters and killed because we had to. Steve runs toward the birds to watch the falcon cling to the body of the slain grouse and calmly rip hunks of bloody meat from the still warm breast. Just a flavor.
It's I like, there's a kind of candor in the book too about your, it's not distaste, but you talk about the blood sport of it, the kind of the thrill of the kill, I guess. Something that you don't have a taste for yourself, which I think you say toward the end of the book is the reason why you don't think you'll ever be a falconer. It's the one thing that sort of separates you in some ways. Talk a little bit about that, because there is that sort of blood sport that you write about in the book.
It is a blood sport. Yeah. And I think that when most of us think about falconry, before we're really introduced to real falconry and falconers, we don't think about it as a blood sport at all. We conjure up these images of maybe Arabs out or sheikhs out in the desert flying these beautiful white peregrines. We're never sure on what, but they're just flying. Or we think of medieval lords and ladies on horseback with merlins and peregrines. And we never actually go to the hunting part in our thoughts. So when you actually take time to follow a falconer and to see what falconry is really all about, it is about hunting. It's about, this is what these birds are bred to do. This is what they're meant to do. It's how some people do fill their larder with food and how they did it for a millennia. And I'm not a hunter. I've never really hunted, but I've certainly been in the company of a lot of hunting over this past couple of years. Yeah. And I realize that, you know, I just don't have the same taste for it that a true falconer does. So I could probably never go there.
Right. How do you describe it, Steve?
Well, to me, the love is more of the bird itself, the falcon. And the falconer is a partner in a relationship that takes place every day in the wild with wild predators. And the falconer, by having a trained falcon, puts himself in a situation to see the spectacular flight of the world's most incredible flying birds. Mm. And we get to see what they do every day on a natural basis. The peregrine falcons that nest on the buildings in our cities today are capturing the fascination of people all across the country with video cams, and people go out there to watch them, but they seldom ever get to see those birds in the act of hunting. And that is the most spectacular part of what they do. The peregrine falcon can dive at over 200 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. So a falconer is basically an observer in something that would be taking place 365 days a year in the wild with a wild bird. But by having a bird that you can work with and train, you can actually see this magnificent behavior of the birds and witness it and reproduce it day after day. Mm. So that you can see the marvelous flight of the birds.
It must be addicting.
It is. Yeah, it is. And it's very difficult to get it to all go right.
Right.
There's a kind of a Murphy's Law element to the whole thing when you go out there and you're dealing with birds and dogs and sage grouse and falcons and weather and habitat destruction. So, you know, if something can go wrong, it probably will go wrong. But Steve is such – I won't use the word master. He's such a perfectionist at what he does. He makes it look easy when you're with him. You don't realize all this stuff is going on. Steve has this way of being in the field and being in command of what's going on that it seems like this effortless display because things come together beautifully. And I've been to enough different falconry situations now where I know that what he does is really at the pinnacle of the sport.
So, Steve, this is never routine because it's always – there's always something different about it.
Every time. There's always a different scenario, something – you know, we when we're out there in the environment, we're subject to birds that eat our birds. Yeah. We're subject to our birds going after anything they want to go after if they see something. So the amount of control we have is very, very limited once our bird is in the air. And so it makes for an exciting adventure each time they leave the fist. As the caller said, when you're out there and your bird has left and is flying, no matter what's going on in your life or with your work or anything you're having problems, your mind, it's kind of a release.
Yeah.
Because your mind is completely absorbed with the moment.
Is your heart thumping?
Oh, absolutely. And, if it didn't, I probably wouldn't continue to do it.
Yeah, yeah. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Rachel Dickinson, talk a little bit about the history, because you say to understand falconry, you've got to look into the past.
Well, I think you do need to realize that there is a very long history in falconry. It may go back as much as 8,000 years, and it hasn't really existed in a lot of Aboriginal societies, but it may have started in the Middle East. I think some of the earliest signs of it have been around Iraq. And then it made its way pretty quickly to the Far East. And then when the Silk Road opened up, it made its way back west. So here were these Eastern falconers bringing these exotic birds to the west again and to the Middle East and then to England. And so when we follow that thread, it just kind of goes back and forth across Asia and Europe. And it doesn't come to North America until the early part of the 20th century, yeah. Which I find fascinating.
So did I. It's because it was something for the elites, and the elites weren't coming to this country.
Well, they weren't coming here. And also in the 18th and 19th century in Britain, falconry really went into a decline because of the rise of gun hunting. You know, you could – why use a falcon when you can just blow away as many birds as you want with a gun, you know? And they kind of lost the thread to falconry, and it was being held on to very closely by just a really small group of elites, basically. And you're right, they weren't coming to America. And plus, in America, there was so much to be done. We were engaged in nation building, and it took so much just to survive in some ways. And you're dealing with completely different birds. People are coming here. And what's surprising to me is that someone didn't make the connection far earlier in the 17th or 18th century or even part of the 19th century and look at these birds and watch them hunt the way Steve sees these birds hunting all the time that are not falconry birds and think, I wonder if I could do something with that.
Yeah. You say one of your favorite parts of the history of all of this is the list of the things that you're not allowed to do or can do. It's the really regimented world in medieval falconry. And there's still kind of a protocol. Talk about that.
There is. Yes, in the Middle Ages, there some. I'm not sure if this list was actually a satire.
Yeah.
You know, was people looking at nobility and who can do what, or if it was meant to be truthful. But it is interesting. You know, only a king can fly a gyr falcon. Only a prince can fly this. Only a bishop can fly that. And it was very strictly proscribed. Today, falconry is heavily regulated by the federal government and by all the state governments. And so Steve actually doesn't own his birds. You can't own a bird of prey. These birds are owned by the government because you're not allowed to own a migratory bird, even if it's a bird that's been bred in captivity. So the government really has its hand in regulating the sport, telling you where you can hunt, when you can hunt, what kind of birds you can fly. And within the sport itself, there is a pecking order. You start out as an apprentice, then you work your way up to a general falconer and finally to a master falconer. And it takes years to do that. And then within the falconry world, there are people who fly falcons. And there are people who fly—
These are the long wingers.
The long wingers. And then there are people who fly different kinds of hawks. And hawks will go after things like rabbits and squirrels. And it's a completely different kind of falconry. And then there are people—
I like how you talk about that. It's kind of a subculture. The long wingers, it's a smaller fraction of the people who actually do falconry. Is that right?
When I started into my little exploration of falconry, of course, I assumed everyone was like Tim and Steve. I thought everyone flew a peregrine.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Why not? This big, beautiful bird. But as I went to falconry meets, which are annual gatherings of falconers, I realized that these long wingers were really a teeny tiny percentage of the falconers in the United States. Most of them are flying red tails or Harris's hawks. They're not these long wingers. And so, you know, I like to think I've been hanging out with the elite of the falconry world.
Well, and they do see themselves as the elite in some ways.
I think
they, you say, I'm not sure if it's entirely this way, but they almost look down on those who are going after the rabbits and the, you know, the gophers.
Yeah, and the rabbit hawkers think that, you know, Steve and Tim are a bunch of snobs.
Yeah.
You know, with their long wings, they're beautiful birds, you know. So it's just that's the way it is with any kind of social gathering where people are doing different things.
How do you, Steve, these birds are, they're not retrieving. You've got dogs for that, right? I mean, they're hunting. Their job is to just
bring down the quarry.
Bring down the quarry.
And they generally, sometimes they take the quarry down quite a distance from us. And that's, I've lost a number of birds to wild predators when that happens because our birds are subject to being wild animals, and in wild animals, everything eats something else.
Yeah.
And so I think I've lost now 7 or 8 birds to wild predators while I'm hunting them, which
is devastating.
We're talking
about eagles. Eagles for the most part?
Eagles, great horned owls. There's falconers that lose stuff to coyotes and foxes when the bird's down on the ground on a kill. If it happens to take something down in where there's a fox in the grass, the fox will just as soon eat the falcon as steal its kill, you know, so.
If it takes down a grouse, will it start eating it immediately? Do you have to get to it pretty quick?
Yeah, it will. But they will begin to eat. A falcon always begins to eat at the head, where a hawk will just break into a bird, whatever. And falcons kill kind of like a cheetah will knock down its prey and bite its neck to kill it.
Yeah.
Where a lion will just grab it and, you know, bring in. But anyway, falcons are more like a cheetah. They knock their prey to the ground. They seize it, and then they have a very powerful beak. They can actually bite harder than a hawk. Their beak is designed to break the neck of a bird, and that's what the falcons do. That's how they kill their prey. Once they knock it to the ground and stun it, and generally the bird hitting the ground is enough to stun it enough that the falcon can come around and grab it. And as soon as it does, it will it'll break the neck immediately. So the kill is really instant. So when you get up there, the kill has been made by the time you get there because they kill instantly.
When it hits a bird, it hits it with its talons?
The strike comes from experience from a young bird coming in to try to bind to its quarry, and they come in and they try to grab it. Huh. Well, they find that at one time they come in too fast and they do that, and they grab and it tears loose, and they find out how effective that is at throwing the bird off balance. And so the strike isn't done with closed feet. It's done with open feet, and they actually grab. And a bird that's really good at it can come by, and even with one foot, grab the you can't see it unless you had high-speed cameras. God. It will grab the grouse or the duck by the wing with one foot and just hang and go by. It won't even slow down. And and they have such tremendous strength in their feet that it doesn't hurt the falcon. And it just throws the bird out of control. As if when you're running, if you've been pushed from behind you so easily, you lose your balance. You can imagine a bird in flight being struck by another bird coming in at twice its velocity can send that bird out of control, and then it tumbles into the ground, which is generally as damaging to the quarry as the falcon strike sometimes.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Deborah is with us in Salt Lake. Deborah, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and good morning.
Morning.
My question is, my sister was married to a falconer, and she had told me that they literally need to starve the bird to death in order to get it to fly and hunt, because if it was full, it wouldn't want to hunt. And I was also wondering about when it does attack its prey, do you let the bird eat, even though it's a bloody sport, do you let it eat what it catches, or do you have to take that away?
You take on all the stuff in the book. Rachel or Steve?
Steve,
well,
go ahead.
We absolutely don't starve the birds, because our birds have to be just as strong as the wild birds do, because we're hunting wild quarry, and a bird that's starved at all would be weak and would just go to the ground and be absolutely helpless. So our birds have to be a conditioned athlete. And it is true that we don't fly the birds when they've been fed, because no predator will hunt when it's had a meal. So it's after they've – generally the morning that day when they have their meal, after they had their meal, they can't be hunted again. So falconry is a one-shot deal. And you get one chance. If your bird misses, we call it down. We feed it. It's done.
Is that right?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
You don't multiply fly it. And I've been out with gun hunters before that have been out, and they're so loud and they're slamming doors because they have multiple chances to shoot a bird.
Yeah.
I tried to challenge them. I said, well, you guys just all go out, and tomorrow you all have one shell. That's all you have for your whole day of hunting. And let's see if you're a little more intense and a little quieter, and if you approach a little more carefully. It made it a lot more intense. They all had a good time the next day, but they never wanted to do it again.
Rachel, this is why Steve likes to hunt in the winter, right? Because he likes that edge.
Yes, he does like that edge, definitely.
But the birds do, to answer her questions, the birds do begin to feed on the quarry. And generally, I let them feed as much as they want on it. If I'm going to have it for myself to eat, I would prefer to give them a leg, because I prefer to eat the breast. But I let them have the feed on the quarry. Sometimes I will substitute another piece of food for the quarry. But falconry isn't all about capturing the quarry, but it has to happen for the birds to have any kind of success. It'd be like a child that you're trying to teach it to do something and it never succeeds at it. It won't have any confidence that it can succeed. So the falcon has to be able to make a kill. It's a natural thing for both the prey and the falcon, and it's something that, like I said earlier, it happens every day in the wild, 365 days a year with every predatory bird.
At home, we have a freezer filled with duck that has been taken by my husband's falcon. And we feed, he feeds some of it to the peregrine, but basically we eat the whole thing. Anything the peregrine hasn't eaten, we eat.
Deborah, glad you called. Thanks very much. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Before we go to a break, let's take one more call, this time from Chad, who's in Spanish Fork, Utah. Chad, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, I've been listening. I just haven't turned on the radio, and I had a couple comments. I'm an apprentice falconer myself, and this has been something that has been kind of a lifelong dream of mine to become a falconer, and it just hasn't been realized until this last couple years. And I just wanted to make a comment. There was a lot of emphasis, I think, on it kind of culminating with the hunt. And for me, too, though the hunt is exhilarating and it does make you forget everything else. It is that release, so to speak. More culminating for me is just the relationship alone with the bird. I'm one that has kind of grown up wanting to spend my time in the wild, and so for me, having this bird just recognize me and accept me in its presence as a partner in different settings, in the hunt, in the, you know, when I'm out working with her in the muse or just in my backyard, just recognize me as a partner is, for me, just exhilarating to see this wild animal, king or queen of the skies, recognize me as a partner. And it's just quite an amazing thing for me. So the hunt, it is kind of, it is part of the ordeal, but I wouldn't say that it's necessarily the end-all, culminating, you know, the objective of falconry for me anyway.
Hmm. And I would totally agree with that. I mean, even the smell of your bird is something that if people are away from it, and they would come up to a falcon and they've been away from it for a while, and they'll put their nose up to the bird, and there's a certain smell of a
wow.
falcon.
Hmm.
And just the association with the bird and the handling and working with them, it's an incredible bond. But most falconers try to maintain that falconry is a sport where the birds get to fly and hunt. And it really doesn't matter whether they fly or hunt. If someone has one captive and enjoys the hawk and doesn't have the time to hunt it, but yet they read about falconry and in their mind they wish they could take their bird out and hunt it, but they have that incredible relationship with this incredible bird. I see nothing wrong with that, and some falconers do, though. They feel that that's wrong, that you should fly the bird all the time to hunt it. But to the bird, as long as it's cared for and fed well, the bird's happy, mm-hmm. and they probably – I'm sure they do enjoy flying. I do think they do.
Although these birds are not social creatures and I've read that they're not social creatures, I actually don't believe that, because when I see Steve with his birds or Tim with his birds mm-hmm. – these men love these birds. They love everything about them. They say they're not pets, but they go into their muse and they start making little noises and the birds respond to them. There's this incredible bond that I haven't seen between – I think I see it between people and their horses sometimes, and sometimes with dogs, mm-hmm. but it's very intense.
Chad, we're really glad you called. Thanks very much. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us, 801-585-9378. I should mention, if you go to our website, KUER.org/RadioWEST, we have a couple of pictures of Jomo on the website. So they say they're not great photography. Our producer did her best. But, you know, you should see it, KUER.org/RadioWEST. Rachel Dickinson is with us. Her book is called Falconer on the Edge, A Man, His Birds, and the Vanishing Landscape of the American West. Steve Chindrigan, Falconer, he and his staff present daily bird shows, by the way, at the Hogle Zoo. Tomorrow at 7 o'clock, they'll both be at the King's English Bookshop talking about the book. For details, you can call the store at 801-484-9100 or just visit our website, KUER.org/RadioWEST. We have to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Rachel Dickinson is with us talking about her book, Falconer on the Edge, A Man, His Birds, and the Vanishing Landscape of the American West. Steve Chindrigan is also with us, a falconer who's profiled in the book. They're going to be at the King's English Bookshop tomorrow. We'll tell you more about that as we go along. In the meantime, you can join us at 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Rachel Dickinson, I did want to ask you about the environmental story included in this book. Steve's story, you say, is a Western story, and a lot of that's often about loss in the
mm-hmm.
West. Talk about
mm-hmm.
that.
I am not a Westerner. I'm from the East, and so being spending any kind of time in the West was really interesting to me because I saw things I just didn't even know about.
Yeah.
For one thing, and people's relationship to the land is so close. Everyone has horses. Everyone, you know, does something out on the land, and that's not something we see in the East. So when I had the opportunity to spend some time in Steve's cabin in Wyoming over the summer, I took several times I took drives out to some of the natural gas fields that occur right before you hit Pinedale, a little bit south of Pinedale, Jonah Field being the biggest one.
Right.
And I drove in there and just took a look at what was going on and then read all about what the plans were for developing natural gas in that area. And it's really it's like looking at an area that's been devastated because they go in with earth-moving equipment and they just kind of scrape the desert clean in these spots where they're going to put well pads. And most people, when they look at the sagebrush desert, they probably don't think that much about it. They probably don't think about the fact that that 2-foot-tall sagebrush is actually 100 years old. So think about the impact of taking that 100-year sagebrush out, and then how do you mitigate for something like that? And the sagebrush is the habitat for the sage grouse, which is, of course, the prey species that Steve's falcons are flying on. And these species, you know, these sage grouse just have to the question is, can they adapt to this kind of change to their habitat? Will they go elsewhere? The jury's out on what's going to happen with the sage grouse. A lot of studies are being done by various scientists to try to figure out what kind of interruption this will be in their lives if you really take out vast portions of their either wintering habitat or areas where they're nesting or doing their lek behavior.
Steve, yeah.
The area that she's talking about, the Jonas Field, at one time was where I'd seen the largest concentrations of sage grouse anywhere in their range, and I'd see flocks of what would have to be described as thousands. And it was very sad to see that developed, but you know, we only have ourselves to blame. We all drive cars. We all use gas to heat our homes. And it's really hard for us to point a finger at an industry that's trying to supply our demands. And what we need to do is, you know, we need to let everyone know that everyone's concerned. I'm sure people that work for the gas and oil companies are concerned. And I think they're willing to make the sacrifices to take the resources more responsibly if we put the pressure on our officials so that when they use public ground, they'll realize people really care about this land and we've got to reclaim it. And I think they're doing that more now. And I think that long term, it's hard to say how this development will affect the sage grouse. Short term, it's devastating when they come in with a lot of equipment and really, you know, hit a big field. But the technology is getting better where they can drill more wells from one pad. They're reclaiming a lot of the roads with technology. They're putting in, you know, pipelines and everything's digitized. If they can reduce the noise, who knows what the impact will be down the future. Mm-hmm. It may not be as serious as we think.
And Wyoming is – the government in Wyoming is very responsive to this also. They don't want to see anything happening to the sage grouse. They don't want to list it as threatened or endangered because that has a huge impact on the recreational use in Wyoming. So they're working hard.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Brad is with us in Salt Lake. Brad, welcome.
Thanks, Doug.
Sure.
I just wanted to recount an encounter I had with two peregrines last year on Lake Powell. I was boating down the lake and noticed a bird. I didn't really pay attention to the bird at first, but it was a grebe flying along at the same pace my boat was going, right above my boat, only maybe 30, 40 feet. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a peregrine just, wham, hits the grebe, grabs it. The grebe was about the same size as the peregrine. And it was struggling, and its partner, interestingly, had been flying above the first bird. And when the grebe or the falcon dropped the grebe, the second bird dove down and grabbed the grebe. All of this happening right above my head, going along at the same distance. It was really a unique experience, really neat to see. But the grebe was just too big for both of them to handle. It dropped to the water. So I turned my boat around to the grebe's chagrin and drove it back off the water. And the grebe, its learning curve was very short because it never got about a foot above the water as it flew, and the falcons wouldn't fly that low to take it.
Huh. Wow.
It was very, very, very cool to see.
Mm. Brad, glad you called. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's really interesting because we were talking about the history of falconry, and I'm sure that primitive man was used by predatory peregrines for hundreds and hundreds of, not more than that, eons of time before someone got the idea that I'm flushing these game birds for this peregrine and maybe I should reverse things.
Yeah. Exactly. Brad just became the water dog.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Brad, thanks very much. Here's an email from Steve who writes, I used to have an office on the 25th floor at 425 Park Avenue at 56th Street in Manhattan. High up over the city on the 60th floor in a building just north of mine was a nesting pair of peregrines. I used to delight in watching the mom and dad bird coming and going. One day I was looking out over Park Avenue traffic, and I noticed a pigeon flying uptown at about the height of 20 stories in the canyon formed by the buildings. Suddenly, one of the falcons dropped like a stone from far above, hit the pigeon in the back, unleashing a burst of feathers. The pigeon tried limply to shake off the falcon, but the raptor took the pigeon twice, almost as though shaking out a dishcloth, and flew up with its prey to feed the family, all of this over the city streets. One doesn't think of Manhattan as Hawk Central, but in addition to the peregrines, I used to regularly see red-tail hawks. Yeah, you see them here in Utah, Utah.
There's a change in the past, 30 years. Obviously, there were more people with guns, and it used to be people. When I was a kid, there was a bounty on hawks.
Yeah.
And nowadays, people know that they're protected, and the hawks are starting to learn that they're not being chased by people, and we're getting hawks, urban hawks that are nesting in the cities, and there's actually a red-tailed hawk nest within a half a mile of our studio right here. And they are more urban today than they were when we were first developing things.
And peregrines are beautifully suited to an urban environment, to the tall buildings. They've got all those pigeons. It's perfect. Everybody's happy.
Yeah.
And that's with species, extinction is the rule. And species that can adapt to the changes we make are the ones that will thrive. And some that can't will perish. For example, the sage grouse. The raven population is going skyrocketing, and the sage grouse population is going down. Well, the reason is because of all these places that the ravens can nest now out on these tanks that are in the desert where they didn't used to have a place to nest. Hmm. And the nesting of ravens along the riparian areas where there were cliffs was limited by the competition with other birds of prey. And because horned owls would eat ravens and red tails and prairie falcons and eagles need those areas. But these areas out in the desert on these oil wells, the ravens can nest on them, and they're seeing a huge increase, and they're the biggest predator of grouse nests.
Rachel Dickinson, we've about 30 seconds left. Sorry for this question finally, but you say you wonder if there's a place for falconry in the modern world. As you've completed this book, now what do you think?
Yeah, as long as there are people like Steve and Tim out there who are really dedicated to having this kind of relationship with the birds and can find fields to fly in. To me, that was the big thing. As more and more flying fields go under development or natural gas development, mining, and there are all these perils out there, will there be a place left to fly your birds? That was my question.
Rachel Dickinson, her book is called Falconer on the Edge, A Man, His Birds, and the Vanishing Landscape of the American West. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Steve Chindgren, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We should mention Steve gives daily bird shows at the Hogel Zoo. Tomorrow at the King's English Bookshop, they'll be there talking about the book. Just go to our website for details, where you'll see a slideshow there, by the way. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.